Hello and welcome to another three-pronged podcast. Well, actually, it's more of a two-pronged podcast today because Chris, unfortunately, is in London doing London business type things. So you're just stuck with a good self, Neil, and Flav. And tonight, today, we're joined by Emily, who is a tenant farmer just outside Bath. And she has come along tonight to talk about all things to do with tenancy farming, the challenges that a tenant farmer faces, and I think more excited from my point of view is that she's diversified, and she's diversified into my favourite crop, which is grapes, which turn into wine. So that's brilliant as far as I'm concerned. So diversification doesn't get any better. So I welcome Emily, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So
don't forget.
Go on.
Is that what you're going to?
What's that? The good, the bad, and the ugly?
Yeah, I thought you were going to forget that.
No, don't you worry, Brad. We've got it all in control. So we do, obviously, we normally do the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then Chris normally gets involved with that. And Chris, being a sort of dour Northern man, always likes to favour the bad and the ugly because they're always a bit dour. No, I'm joking, Chris. So we're going to crack on tonight. So I'm going to start off with the good. Should we do the good first? The good being, I've had a day today, which is took my daughters out, took my mum out for lunch, which is like, doesn't sound great, but it's just one of the most simplest and cheapest things you can actually do. You know, I'm a self-employed person, I've got my own business, no different to any of the farmers and anybody else who's got their own stuff going on. So actually, do you know what? I'm just going to say today, I'm not going to do work, I'm not going to look at my phone, I'm not going to look at emails, I'm actually going to go out and just get away from it all. Because I think that's just one of the most important things that you can do running any business, whether it's a farm, contracting, no matter what you're doing, just to turn around and say, do you know what? I'm leaving it today. I'm going out. I'm doing something different and enjoying the family, because I don't think we put enough time into enjoying family and stuff. So that's my good. Emily, you've got quite an interesting bad.
Yeah. Well, I'm going bad because on Saturday there was a hailstorm and I was stood drinking coffee at my mum's house with my brother, and I looked out the window, this hailstorm and this almighty flash of light and what sounded like a bomb going off that hit one of our barns, the apex of an old sort of 16th building, blew the apex off, stone everywhere, and then found out it travelled right the way through the barns, right through every building, blowing basically anything that was connected to the internet. So all the routers, the TV, the desktop monitors, all the workshop buildings had their same thing happen to them. And it's just unbelievable. Keep saying, if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I would have just been, what the hell is happening here? It's just madness.
That's insane.
It's
crazy. I can remember years ago.
Yeah, the boiler as well, that's it.
Being in a barn and getting hit by lightning, and it was like when I worked on a dairy farm, and it just wrote the parlour off, didn't write it off, but like this parlour was like 12 months old, and it just went through the milking parlour, and they hadn't put a proper roof into the parlour when they built it, and all the computer boxes, and there was like 48 of them, something in there. I remember the sparks just raining down off this shed.
Oh my gosh.
You never thinking, don't touch anything, don't move.
Yeah.
So,
are the chances of it happening, really? It's just mad, isn't it?
It is, it's bonkers. It is absolutely bonkers. But as long as no one's hurt, that's the main thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah. And lucky there was no one in the barn at the time.
And Flav.
Yeah, I've got the ugly. So yesterday I was coming back from Kent and I get a message from Nikki saying, you know, there's a horse in one of the fields. And I was like, oh, great. I thought it was someone I knew that I put a horse in there. So I was like, I have a word with them. Contacted them and they were like, nah, that's not my horse. My horse is in the stable. Next day I drove past this morning and I actually saw it and I was like, oh, it looked like it was his the day before because it was a bit dark by the time I got back. But it turned out it wasn't. And then on my way back home at lunch, I found a van by the entrance to the gate, and I stopped, and I was like, hi, how's it going? Why have you got a horse in there? He was like, oh, this belongs to the previous tenant. And I was like, no, it doesn't, because he's not been here for nearly a year now. And he sort of looked at me blankly. He's like, oh, well, I paid him for using this field to graze my horse. And I'm like, well, he's not been here for a year. And even when he was here as a tenant, he wasn't supposed to have that field because it wasn't his. So you might have paid him, but he's mugging you off because that's not the case. Yeah. Anyway, after a bit of a chat, I said to him, look, you're telling me you paid for 2 weeks. I'll take your word for it. Have it there for 2 weeks, but after that 2 weeks, you've got to move it. And he's like, okay. Well, his hands were fit. He's pulling something out of the ground. I was like, need a COVID elbow tap. And I was like, right, okay. After 2 weeks, that horse is going to be gone. And on one hand, I'm thinking, okay, maybe he's fibbing. Maybe he's pulling a fast one. But on the other, I'm like, I've got so much other shit to worry about. I do not want to be creating enemies. Like, if he's there for 2 weeks, the horse will have the grass and you'll move on and the grass will grow back and I'll put sheep in there. So it's not a win-win, but I'm just like, for the sake of my peace of mind, I just say, okay, whatever.
Smart move, to be honest, really. Smart move. Or next week's Good, the Bad and the Ugly. We're talking about how you've got 16 horses in your field.
Exactly.
Bring the mates down. Well, we're going to go
one way. Yeah, so sometimes you're just going to pick your battles, and today wasn't a battle to pick. Emily, tell us a bit more about you, because and like some people like me who shares a fair bit online, when you try and do research on you, it's not easy.
Oh, really? So,
tell us about you.
Okay. So I'm a third generation farmer. We moved second generation on this particular farm. So my granddad was a farmer through the war down in Devon, and then we moved up to the West Country. And then we moved as a family to Corson Fields Farm here near Bath. So in 1984, I think. And then I took the tenancy on from Dad 6 years ago. We are sort of arable, so we've changed dramatically in the last year, but we've done previously conventional wheat, barley, linseed. And then most recently, in the last 7 years, I've been doing quinoa, which is not conventional. It's sort of organically, I say, organic principles, sort of growing with organic principles. And then in 2016, we planted 5 acres of vines. So that's English sparkling wine that we produce. And so the vineyard's still kind of growing and it's still maturing. It's still got a wee way to go before it's sort of fully fledged vineyard. But we're getting there. And in this last year, I've completely done a huge overhaul of the farm, really, because my dad's kind of supposed to be retired, but he's like typical farmer, works every day. He's very happy to work every day, not doing the accounts anymore. And I think that's his sort of idea of retirement, really. But I kind of forgot that point where I was like, I can run the farm on my own, but do I get any, employees? I can't really afford to employ someone full time. Can't really have Dad working full time as well. So the changes we've made is doing a lot more stewardship. And I'm doing low input cereals. So I grow, again, with organic principles, cereals for a local bakery, Landrace Mill. So they've got a mill just down the road, and they've been taking our grain, which has been great. So I'm sort of growing really specifically for them. And they're sort of part of a Southwest Grain Network. So that our flour get milled and then sent all over to different bakeries across the Southwest and up to London and what have you, which is really cool. And then, like say, we've got the quinoa, linseed and and the grapes. So kind of a bit of change this year, sort of moving away from conventional agriculture, really. Giving that a go and trying to make the most of the kind of stewardship and SFI offers that we have so that we can kind of cover our bases if we have a poor year like last year. You know, you get a few failed crops, you don't get paid for it. So at least with the kind of some of the SFI options and the kind of stewardship options that I have, at least my kind of rent's covered, you know, and have a bit of a breather there. So yeah, it's all changed my end, but it's kind of exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
I think it sounds what you're doing is like really good, because you're not sort of like what you say. I think you're not farming conventionally, you're farming to the market that's there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Advantage exactly what's there, and I think that's really good to see, because I think a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking advantages of SFIs and things like that. If they're there available, then why wouldn't you take advantage of them, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And also, I mean, and I think, you know, from a business point of view, it's really exciting being involved with wine. I know we sort of get straight to the thing straight away, but but it's, I think the British, the English wine industry, I just think it's fascinating how it's grown, you know. And I'm not a wine connoisseur by any stretch of the imagination. I like wine. I like drinking wine. I do quite like learning about wine because I think it's a really interesting product. You know, there's so much to know about it. And a little bit I have learned. I'm very fortunate. We've got a little tiny vineyard at the bottom of the hill here called Wiverley.
Okay.
And they, I think it's about 4 acres, and they're doing really, really well. 4 or 5 acres of vines, and they're growing this Pinot Noir.
Yeah, nice.
And it's won all these awards, and it is like absolutely just, you know, it's not cheap, but it's, you know, you won't be drinking every night or even every week. But it's there might be a bottle of it downstairs on the shelf there just for a special occasion. Because it is, you know, and it's just so exciting to see this, you know, this whole industry growing. Even where you are, Flav, because down in the south coast there.
When we used to live in Sussex,
So
actually, I never used to drink wine, apart from when, I don't even think that's wine, in church. Like, brought up as a Catholic, when you go and get the, they call it, Body of Christ or whatever. I used to think that was wine. It's not wine. But from 2017, March, I started drinking wine properly. And I think I went, because a few of my friends work in the wine industry, I went about 6 months of only drinking English wine.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try and keep it. But then every time you went to pubs or restaurant, have you got English wine? No.
Yeah.
Some people didn't even know it existed back then. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, you don't know this. Especially like in sort of Surrey, Hampshire. Anyone in a restaurant that told me there isn't any wine, I'd give my lesson there and then.
Yeah, right.
But talking of awards, Neil, do you know how many awards Emily's got?
Cool.
So last year you got Taste of the West, you got gold.
Yep.
You've got gold gold IEWA 2023.
Yep. Independent Wine Awards, English Wine Awards.
Yeah, you've got a silver London Wine 2023. You got a decanter bronze 2020. That's insane.
Yeah.
And you say the vineyard is not it's still young. It's done already.
Well, that's our first vintage. That's the only one we've released now. We've got others bottled that we need to release. It was really like you plant it and then there's so much care and put into it before you see your end sort of result. You know, because you pick the grapes and we're using the traditional champagne method. So it's laid down for at least 2 years. It's very slow, like whole thing process is really, really slow. You kind of almost forget that you're producing wine because you just get so tied up in the vineyard and, you know, got to do this job.
Where's the wine go to get sort of bottled?
Down at Hattingley Valley, they've produced our wine, that first vintage. But we're moving up to Whiston Estate. West Sussex, So we grew last year for cash flow. We just sold all our grapes to them, and they're making wine with our grapes this year. They're really happy with the Chardonnay. So that's a really good partnership for us. So that next year, what we'll do is probably sell them a majority of the grapes, and then we'll just hold, 5,000 bottles back or whatever and it's just a good trade-off then. Right. But you get tied up in the vineyard, and you get, like, for me, I just think about the plant, the soil, like the health of the thing. And then when you actually sort of taste your wine for the first time, it's like the maddest thing, because you're just like, oh, this is what I'm doing it for, it's kind of a weird, you don't associate the growing bit with the actual sort of drinking bit. It sounds odd, but it's a pretty special moment when we try it for the first time. And we've just loved the fact that it's done so well in the awards. Everyone's just been raving about it. And it kind of, feels proud to say we're award-winning vineyard now. So it's a nice feeling. Yeah.
Did you go to like any courses before this? Because obviously it's not like going to market and buying bottle lambs buying a couple of wieners. Getting a vineyard is literally you're going in fully.
Yeah. No, we went all in. So my husband, he is, we had gone down to France. My family are from France, sort of down in Bordeaux region, and we'd been down there, and he was like, God, the soil's really, really looks like our soil. Like, it's really similar. And so he was working in IT and really wanted to get out of his job. And I was like, well, if you're gonna come to the farm, you wanna work on the farm, we've got to do something that's gonna create a job, basically. So it was really his instigation of planting the vineyard. And then he's just really recently finished his job, so he's now full-time in the vineyard, so everything has kind of worked the way we plan it to work, and it's brilliant, because at the moment we're pruning and there's a lot going on, and he's able to do that himself. We've had contractors in, it's really expensive, but now it's kind of at that point where, like, okay, the vineyard's making money and he can be full-time doing this now as well, so it's really awesome.
You've got the best market in the world on your doorstep, being in
Bath. Right.
You're so incredibly fortunate to, there's some really good, there's a lot of people there who are drinking wine.
Yeah, they love it. And a lot of restaurants in Bath are pouring by the glass as well. So, for them, it's a brilliant markup, and it's a lovely story. They're 5 miles from Bath, so it's just ideal for them. Yeah. Yeah.
Like you say about the soil and stuff, because I didn't realise this until I learned a bit more about it. And was obviously the Champagne region in France, or the soil in the Champagne region, exactly the same as the soil in Kent. It just runs under the sea.
Yeah.
And the same, obviously, we can't. And that's why we can grow some fantastic sparkling wines in this country, because we have exactly the same. We can't call it Champagne, obviously, but we can, we can grow this amazing sparkling wine. I just think it's brilliant. Yeah. I just love it.
And a lot of the champagne houses are buying up masses of land in Kent now. They're coming over here. I don't know whether they ever call it French wine. I don't know.
I remember.
They'd be proud enough to.
In 2017, I remember, I think that's when Tattinger had bought like 40 acres in Kent.
Yeah.
But then, like you say, they can't call it champagne, can they?
No.
No, but it has to be grown in the Champagne region.
Yeah, I don't know what sparkling is in French.
We've got the climate they had 50 years ago, so that's the change.
Global warming is terrible. Let's get me wrong; it's awful. But if the byproducts of global warming is that we grow more wine in the UK,
bad
trade off. I'm sorry.
yeah.
Didn't really say that. So I could quite happily talk about wine all night, but there's other parts to your business as well. And obviously being a tenant farmer, do you want to talk to us about being a tenant farmer?
Yeah. So, we've had quite a shocker the last few weeks, where we discovered that in a long-term planning document from the council, our farm has a big circle over the top of it for development, which has been a real shock. Kind of heard secondhand through a neighbour, didn't even hear through the council or the landlord. So we've, up until now, tenancy has been absolutely fine. Always been very proud to be a tenant of this particular landlord. And it's been a real shock to us to discover that, you know, they've sort of been making plans behind our backs. And so, yeah, it's the first time I've really felt like a tenant, to be honest. I think up until now, we've always had the security and the safety and sort of, you know, I'm on an AHA, so I'm second generation. You kind of assume that you're going to have it for three generations, you know, and you settle into your tenancy, you put your investments in, you do all these sorts of things. And then this has happened and it's been a real shock. And you'll suddenly feel like quite an insignificant part of the puzzle, you know. So I have talked to my landlords and they reassure me that, you know, they're not gunning for this to happen. And, you know, actually it's down to the council. If the council decide that it's the right place to build, then they're not going to resist it. And that's kind of where we are. But we'll get some kind of, you know, they did say, you know, we're not going to leave you high and dry. But the shock is, you know, this is our home and this is what we've built our entire business around, being on this land, you know, the soil type. We're growing the crops that suit the soil type, with, you know, the location, the vines, which are such a huge investment, and you plant them for 100 years, you know, not planting them for 10 years or 20 years. We're looking after them so that they're going to be here long after we're gone. So it's tenancy wise, it's just been been a real shock. And it's really weird because I sort of posted a few things on Instagram and I've had probably 10 other tenants around the country, all different parts of the country, just going, we're going through exactly the same thing. Just like, Jesus Christ, you know. And in amongst all of this, it's all about housing and nothing about food security. Just, it doesn't even come up on the objections. You know, there's just no, people are really keen to save the green belt. We've got a lot of support because obviously they see that we do a lot of conservation work. Locals are really getting behind us. They don't want to see the countryside ripped up, you know. But food security just doesn't come into the play, you know. It's just like, well, we're digging out all these farms, you know.
It doesn't. I mean, I was talking to really a good friend of mine who was doing some work, actually. He's a sort of local sort of freelance, I call him a consultant, advisor and stuff. And he was talking about, he did a lot of his work is with tenants and representing tenants. Well, he does work for both. He works for landlords and he works for tenants. You know, he's not just both sides of the, you know, he's both sides of the coin. But he was telling me about a story, not where there's building coming in, but it was a different scenario because basically this tenant was living in a house that was just falling down. It was just and the landlord wouldn't let them do anything to him. They were happy to, let's just, you know, we're happy to spend our own money on getting this house right. Mm. Landlord was just no, you know, and you just think, I don't know. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know if you can, like, you see so much on the news about poor housing, don't you? And poor landlords. And yet, you know, there is some fantastic landlords in this country and there's some brilliant, brilliant, you know, landowners and stuff like that in the country that have tenants on there and they provide and support for their tenants. But I think there's probably there will be a significant number there that will be having some really, really terrible challenges. And on what can they do? You know, what can they, there is very, very little they can do because they can't afford to walk away. It's not probably an analogy to a house is pretty poor because at the end of the day, you can pack stuff going to somewhere else. You can't pack your farm up. You no. can't root 5 acres or 4 acres of vines. That's all right, don't worry. We'll shut them somewhere
yeah,
out.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't. You just can't do it. And it's just, no. it's just, no. it's a, it is a terrible, terrible situation. I don't know.
Yeah. What,
I mean, I always look at it, you know, I'm not a farmer, as I keep saying, but I do, I empathise 100% with what, you know, what you're saying and from other people I know that are just, yeah, you know. And I think some of the challenges now, there's a large estate by me, and there are, they're slowly sort of on that estate. Probably if you went back 10 years ago, there might have been 10 small dairy farms on that estate.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's only two now, maybe three. And they're just slowly doing their best to kick them off and change them and get them off. And then, but what they're doing is they're farming that the estate themselves. They've got a contract farming arrangement with a local contractor. Mm. And it's just a sheer avoidance tax, that, you know, to avoid inheritance tax, because that's taking the change. So it's like, we can take it all in and have farm it ourselves. We're going to, you know, we're going to miss some inheritance. And that's like a, I don't know how many thousand acres that is, but it's a big chunk of land. And it's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really unsettling, the whole thing. And you know, we've got a lot of local support, which is great, but... Yeah, for me, I just, when I hear the other tenants who are going through the same thing, you just go, Jesus, we can't, you just can't keep building and building and building on Greenbelt. Like, it's just, we've got brownfield sites. The Greenbelt sites are great because, well, I just can't come in on this farm, for instance, free draining soil, pretty flat, just build straight onto it. You don't have to clear away brownfield wastes and it, you know, that it suits the bottom line of the developer. But you will just turn into a suburb, you know, of Bath, and you know, everyone who's living in villages now, they just get joined up, merged in, and then there's just this no green space between villages.
It's shocking. You know, I went up to see my, you know, mum today who lives in Stoneleigh, so HS2 literally just ploughing right past, which is just like bonkers. You know, you drive over, like, my girls are like, Jesus, Dan, look at this. And then I saw, you know, drove around the back of Stoneleigh up for another village. She'd been out for lunch. And like, you know, it's some land that I've not driven down that lane for a long, long time. I'm like, what the hell is that behind that massive, you know, mountain of earth? And it was like this huge distribution centre that they've just chucked up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, walking down roads that weren't roads there before, most of my job. And it's just like a sea of warehousing and all. And you look at that warehouse, and it's like the size of Manchester, but there's only probably four people working it because it's automated. So it's not creating loads of jobs for local people, you know, because it'll be all like robotic picking and all the rest of it in there, and there'll be like four people in there working, and that's it.
Yeah.
And you just think, when's it going to stop?
It's so worrying and dangerous because we're thinking, and a lot of this, as much as I hate doing anything, like if I can avoid, especially in farming, if I can avoid listening or working with government, I'd rather do it because you've got people there that have zero to no idea what goes on the ground, but they're the ones putting policies out. And I think the issue here is at the top, these people that don't have a clue what's going on the ground or have a clue and don't care, they're putting policies in. And it affects the majority of people, but because they're tying it to other things, like when you hear talks like, oh, well, there's more to it than just import and export of food. There's more. But when lockdown happened, and there's a shortage of pasta or the tiniest thing, everyone panics. When there's no water in Spain or Morocco and we've got short of tomatoes, people are panicking. We're not thinking that let's try and be more food secure because...
Yeah.
And I think I remember it was the president of Rwanda when Ukraine went to war, and sort of some African leaders were panicking about, oh, we import a lot of cereal from Ukraine. He was quoted saying, "Why does a continent of 1 billion people rely on a country of 44 million to feed them?"
Yeah. Like,
why is UK suddenly becoming a country that wants to just sit back like a baby bird, like a chicken in a nest with your mouth open, waiting to be fed.
Yeah,
because when India kicks off like they did last time and said they're not going to export any rice until they feed themselves, what are we going to do?
Yeah, and
when it's so frustrating. It's
there is no sort of following from last week's pod and stuff. I'd love to get some politicians on here because to talk about
it'd be a waste of time. It'd be a waste of time.
No, I quite enjoy the sport. just for my own self gratification, to be honest with you. There is nothing about food security. It does not seem an issue.
Doesn't even feature. And do you know the other thing that I've been finding really quite upsetting about? We've been doing a lot of campaigning just to say, you know, save the green belt, got loads of people involved. I'm probably the youngest person in the room at every meeting. I'm like, where are the young people? Where are the kids? Like, this is their future. Mm. And there's just complete apathy. Mm. And they're the ones that are being taught at school about saving the planet and saving the green belt, saving the climate. But when it comes to campaigning about this kind of thing, they're just not, they're not here. Like, where are they? And they don't care? Do they not know? Or is it just that it's too big and they just think that's your problem, you've got to deal with it? And we're not getting down to younger people and so that they're understanding that this is their future, this is their land. If we can't grow food on this, their local land, this is potentially going to be a massive problem for them. You know, forget about us. We'll be gone in 20, 40 years, whatever. You know, these youngsters, they're just, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that, you know, and I don't know whether it's just the area that we're in or whether it's just...
I've had a few times, like on when they do... Radio 1 News, and they call it Newsbeat, I think. And a few times, like when there's been those news of like climate change, you got people like Greta and stuff.
Yeah,
they always interview young people on there. And I think it's called, I think someone was interviewed before talking about like something like climate change anxiety or something like that about having feeling, obviously worrying about the future, but feeling like it's such a big thing. Let's say if you're being told about polar bears in the Arctic or whatever, there's nothing you can do about that as a person. But people forget that it starts from the tiniest things. Like if it means, I don't know, not wasting food, buying enough food that you can eat and you're not throwing it away. Suddenly, if everyone does that, food isn't one of the sort of biggest wastages up there. And then you've got, I don't know, even if it's turning off lights, switching off machines, little things like that. But I think, like you say, if it's, these things aren't being taught at a sort of broken down at school, they're just being told the Arctic is melting, the ice is melting. Yeah, someone will be like, oh, that's too big, I can't do anything. Drop it down. Like, don't buy 10 eggs, buy 6, because you don't need 10. Little things like that. You don't need to have 6 cars outside your house. You can have 4, like commute when the train turns up. And little things like that.
And then, you know, in the meetings, we've got the older folk who were, you know, just straight out the World War II, remember rationing, they remember food security. It's got to, you know, and they're the ones who are going, well, we can't let farmland go. We can't let it go. It's really, they remember what it's like to queue for a loaf of bread. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And I just feel like we've just lost that.
It's
I
way
find
too
it
comfortable.
Really concerning.
It's too comfortable at the moment.
It really
we
is.
Thought that COVID was going to put people back to factory settings, but people forgot very quickly.
Yeah, they did.
I think we definitely need another something else. I don't know what it is, but we need something to put people back to earth. Because everyone's forgotten 2020.
I think it goes, I mean, because, you know, like, I think it has to start in schools. And maybe that's a future thing we could, you know, get somebody, you know, within education to talk to them about it, because it does clearly, you know, start in schools where food comes from. People have to have a, you know, a clear understanding of where that food comes from. But I was driving at the motorway today, and I had this thought. I thought I've passed about six Arctics, livestock, you know, hauliers, like, you know, big Arctics full of cattle or sheep. And I was thinking, you never used to see lorries that big full of cattle and sheep. And I'm thinking, why is that? And it's obvious why that is, because there's no local abattoirs. Everything's just shipped all around the country. So, you know, there's this whole industry where cattle are shipped. You know, the most premium, no, not the most, one of the premium brand supermarkets that begins with a W, so come to your own conclusions, they use one abattoir or maybe two up in Yorkshire.
Oh, really?
I've got like a farmer who's a friend down in Somerset, one of my best mates, and he's an organic guy, and he was supplying there, and he stopped. He's still organic, and he sort of puts them into his local abattoir now himself, and he can take them there. He said the main reason he stopped was because an Arctic would come, pick up 10 animals, drive them all around Somerset, and then it would drive up to Yorkshire. And he's thinking, I don't want that. I've just spent 2.5 years investing and you know, getting done right. And then it's going to be stressed out of its brain going on a lorry to Yorkshire. And you think, and again, it's just like one of these many, many, many problems that we face in this country that it's, you just look at it. And I think it just has to start with education. People have to be educated of where their food comes from, because people don't know. You go into a supermarket now, and you know, I made the mistake of the day. I was grabbing some stuff, and I was like, "Okay, oh look, you know, early season British asparagus. I love a bit of that. I chuck that in." And I grabbed some sweet corn. When I got it home, I didn't really think about it because I was rushing. It's like India, and I felt so bad. Like, you know, I brought something. No offense to the, you know, the Indian agriculture.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm all for supporting any agriculture, but I felt so bad that I brought this packet of, you know, baby sweet corn. I didn't even think about it. I was like, oh, that'll do. Yeah, chuck that in the basket.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, Jesus, I'll just, you know, where's this food? This food's been flown in for four pieces of baby sweet corn, or six or whatever it was.
And you just think, why don't we the farm shop where I work, the farming family there, the Colettes, Steve, the old boy, he gave me a couple of sweet corn the other week, which he grew there, and he froze it to see how it freezes. For then next year, or this year, if we grow some and we have any surplus, rather than it being sold for 15p or being thrown out in landfill, you freeze it and we can use it when we're buying stuff from Senegal.
Because
lo and behold, there's people in India with no food and it's coming here. There's probably people in Senegal with no food and it's coming here.
You know, there will be a lot of people going hungry in India. That's absolutely right. And I've just eaten some of their food. That just makes it even worse.
To go a little bit positive before we get any more wound up, we're talking about getting people to know about where their food comes from, etc. You mentioned there, Emily, that some of your grain that you grow, and I'm assuming it's not just the standard mainstream varieties. You mentioned that it goes to a local, would you say, mill?
Mill, is it called mill?
Yeah,
Landreth Bakery,
yeah, a local mill, and you said some of it goes to London, and also another crop you grow, and a quinoa there. I'm pretty sure that's quite niche. How have you found that that supply chain is? Because we've just spoken about the big lorries and
doing that? The quinoas. So I contract grow for the British Quinoa Company, and then I keep some of it back and I sell that to local delis and restaurants and whatnot. So that's quite a good arrangement for me. It's a really niche crop. It's like one of those things that you see on the menu kind of through the summer. It's not a staple. And we try to sort of make it more of a staple so that people are using it instead of rice, or, you know, try and incorporate it more into hot meals, because I think a lot of people see it as a salad type dish. Yeah. So it's trying to break that mindset with it. But it's been a tricky one, I'll be honest, because it's kind of one of those things that it's quite expensive to grow. It's a low yielding crop. So I always try and price it below the standard supermarket price. And that's the stuff that's coming from Peru, for instance. So I try and pitch it just below that. People like it because one of the reasons is, well, they know if it's not coming from Peru, the Peruvians, it's been reported it's become too expensive for even locals to eat over in Peru, because actually they're finding it better to send over here. God knows how much that Peruvian farmer is being paid for a kilo of quinoa, but I'm guessing it's probably not £6 or £7, you know. So people like to support British because they know it's not coming all that way and it's not being taken from locals. So there has been a good support with it. But it's niche and it's getting it out there. And sometimes, you know, you get it out in a restaurant and then you kind of don't hear from them again. But then someone will say, oh, I tried your quinoa at this such and such restaurant. Really? I haven't
heard from them for a while.
12 months. It's like, oh, you're still on the menu then.
Yeah.
So, and you I know, think there's a bit of that that goes on.
Yeah, sorry, Emily. And I think there, and I've got friends that supply pubs and restaurants, etc. There are some nowadays, and I had a chat with some from London the other day. There are some that are sort of true. If they support someone, like they send their chef to the farm, they visit, and they go through the whole thing. But like you say, a lot of, there are a fair few out there that you buy something from Neil once, and then you keep it on the menu for a year.
So we're growing, for Landrace Bakery, we're growing a red wheat, which is a Canadian hard wheat. They seem to really, really love that one. It's got, well, they sort of, it's got a kind of purpley reddish hue on it. So it makes the loaf a really nice colour, and it's got a quite a sort of rustic taste. And then we're growing Maluka, which is a pretty bog standard milling wheat. But next year we've got some more interesting sort of heritage wheats, I suppose, lined up, and some red lammas and different sort of varieties that you probably know. Fred Price down,
yeah.
Got new farmer,
yeah, Fred, yeah.
So I've been kind of chatting to him about trying some different varieties through him. He's amazing, such an amazing guy. He's
Fred
really
knows so much. We need to get him on here, but he doesn't like being on center stage.
He's the most modest person I've ever met, and he's just delightful. But I had a really good time with him. Went down to visit him last summer and looked at his seed field trials and stuff. He's just really just such a visionary for wheat. He's just amazing for British agriculture. Yeah, he's so really inspiring. So going to try and get a few more interesting varieties of him this year. It's quite hard to get hold of the seed. So especially this year, it's been like really, really difficult to get hold of seed.
Can you keep any back? Or
yeah,
is there
yeah,
a risk
yeah, we
of...
could do. Yeah, we could do. And So this year it's kind of just the two varieties, but they are growing, you know, with no input. So that, you know, that's what they want. I'm very, very happy to accommodate that. And I just have, we're not going organic because I've just heard really bad things about Organic Soil Association, and I don't really want to go down that route. And the fact is, my customers are happy that we have an open door policy, have a complete honesty with them. I say to everyone that like, you can come and visit anytime. I like, had nothing to hide. Really love showing people around the farm and seeing not just their crops growing, but see all the conservation work that we do, which is really quite central to the farm. So the fact that they don't want the sort of organic stamp is great for me. And it just leaves it a good open kind of relationship in that sense, where we just sort of everyone trusts each other. And so Landrace have been great. I mean, they pay above what I would sell to open field or to the open market. But it's lovely because I send my grain there and I get feedback from the bakers, and it's just lovely.
Yes,
I mean, it's
that's like, so good.
Yeah, it's like your pigs, right? You know, you see it, a pork chop on a plate, and there's a picture, and it's just, there's something so satisfying about hearing that. And that's, to me, what farming is all about. It's having that community around you. You're providing them with what they want, fulfilling that need, and then getting the feedback. And it's just magical, you know? And for years, we've just filled up 29-ton lorries. Off they go to Portbury or wherever they're going, some feed mill and or a dock somewhere, and you never hear anything back. You know, you get a claim probably.
And I think back to what we were saying earlier about like the size of things now and stuff. I think that's where a lot of the legislation and governments worldwide, I'd say, that's probably where they want things to go. Because if the people in the supply chain are talking, then there isn't any room for anyone to mug anyone off. But the way the setup is now, at the bottom, like even let's say pig farming, I've since coming on the tenancy farm and doing everything myself, the only thing I don't do or can't do, or I can but not legally, is the slaughter.
Yeah.
Other than that, I do everything. And talking to big time pig farmers and people that have pig farmed for years that have never been, once the animal gets on a lorry, that's it.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's the point? I did that for sort of 10 odd years and you just lose motivation. And I think, is that why people don't care about farming anymore? Is that why farmers are struggling for mental health?
Yeah.
Because aside from all the other issues, you've got no job satisfaction.
It comes back to what I was saying earlier, wasn't it? When you know, comment about arctics full of cows and sheep trekking up and down the country, they just disappear off, don't they? They just go. So whether you're producing, you know, like you say, Emily, wheat, or you're producing cattle, sheep, no matter what it is, unless you're, you know, selling direct to the consumer. And I don't think everybody can sell direct to the consumer. Mm. But I think actually what you're doing is actually really interesting, because you're sort of like a bit of a halfway house, really, aren't you? Because you're not sort of like, you haven't got a bakery on the farm and you're not there milling your bread and making it yourself and shipping it down to Bath every morning. Yeah. What you are doing is supplying to a local bakery and you're getting that feedback. And I suppose the same with your grape, your vines as well. You're sort of mid that halfway thing as well. And I think that's, you know, so you are getting that feedback. So I think it's brilliant, because majority of farming, you do not get the feedback, you know, only when there's a problem, only when the sale count and the milk goes up, or, you know, goes up, or something gets rejected in the slaughterhouse because there's something wrong with it. Whatever it might be, or your, you know, the hemp or weight of the wheat isn't right. All these different things that you get the kicking for. So I think it is really refreshing what you're doing. And I think you're right, Flavor, you know, around mental health. I think it's funny, we keep recording these and we also come back to the same thing, and that's like this whole supply chain. So we've spoken a lot at length about, you know, supply chain fairness. It's your favourite subject, Flav. And it's, but it's, you know, the supply chain is that something leaves the farm and ain't got a clue where it goes. And that's it. Cheers, ta, bye. And there is no general, you know, feedback. I know some retailers are trying to involve the farmers more. I know that, so it'd be unfair not to say that. But it's, I think, you know, the mental health point of view, it's, if farmers could get more involved, have more feedback of their products, see where it goes, actually see the factories that it goes into, and products that are created from it, then it would gives you a sense of ownership, doesn't it? Like you said, when you're talking about your wine, you're drinking something that, you know, until whatever was down the road in your field growing on
the farm.
And you're thinking, well, bonkers, I'm drinking this stuff that is like, you know, you've got that satisfaction there, haven't you? So maybe that's what could happen in agriculture more.
Yeah, and it's taken time to develop these relationships and, you know, do it through social media, which is great. You know, that as much as I sometimes hate it, it actually, you do meet like-minded people and you can network quite well. It's been instrumental in my business. I would say all of my customers have come through Instagram. You know, because they can see what you're doing on the farm. They like what you're doing, and they are, you know, doing conservation work. You're doing, trying out different things, and you know, people become quite invested in it, and they're invested in your journey, and they're like, actually, go and talk to this person and see if we can do something. And it's taken a while, but you know, we've got there and we've got the right people. And like Landrace, they bought a stone mill, so they, you know, they've been really being able to scale up their milling, and so all those sorts of things. It's just a great feeling, you know, sort of dropping off some grain over there, and you know, we swap with a loaf of bread and you know, have a coffee with them, and you know, and the bakery's just full and all these lovely fresh loaves, and it's your wheat, and it's just,
with my fellow tenants around here, like James and Alison. They've got chickens. They'll bring me eggs. I'll give them sausages. Or down the road, he got Barry. I'll give him sausages or a joint. He'll give me hay. Or the other day, he shut his animal feed shop, and unfortunately, circumstances changing. And I've looked for a muckfork everywhere, and I've not found, you know, the proper four prong muckfork with like a T handle.
I think the three prong one's best myself.
Three prong, good shout. this was four prong though. I saw it in their shop. I was like, "Can I have that?" She said, "Yeah, you can have it." So then I'll pay for it. I didn't have cash on me, or my wallet on me. And then a few days later, my friend Nicola messaged, said, "Oh, when you're coming over, do you mind bringing us X amount's worth of pork?" And I said, "Okay, I'll bring it over." She went to give me the money. I said, "No, that's for that fork you gave me."
Yeah,
and it's those things that have been completely lost over time. But I think to go back a little bit to a point you made there about the organic and sort of assurance, really, and then you mentioned about having the open door policy. That's definitely something we're doing too, because after working in commercial setup most of my farming career up until I'm sort of here. And every time, especially pigs, if you're not assured and you're not selling directly to someone, you're finished. Like, you need to have either Red Tractor or RSPCA or organic or whatever. And for me, being assured and making sure the customer's looking for a Red Tractor and no blah, 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 blah is good for the farmer. That's one narrative and that's good, but we know it's not. Secondly, before, there used to be these different tiers of assurance. So, like, I remember when I worked somewhere, we're building a new pig unit, and we spoke to people of an assurance thing, and I said, if you built it like this, you get a premium of X amount pence per kilo. Guess what happened after spending nearly a million quid on a building? No premium. And you're doing an audit with someone from whichever one of the two I mentioned.
Yeah.
And I remember from one of them, someone telling me at the last place I worked, we had the sows outdoors, they fired outdoors, dry sows stayed outdoors. Those sows, the paddocks are too big for them. I'm like, what do you mean? They're outdoors. How can a paddock be too big? And you've got these things where people are literally following a box. And the same assurance scheme said we couldn't sell the pigs as use their logo to sell the pigs because they were slaughtered at an abattoir that wasn't vetted by them. I'm like, okay, so this is our closest abattoir, and I've told you that abattoirs are tight for money anyway. It's a small abattoir. And for them to invest in whatever you want them to invest in, they need to have enough customers. I want that, and they don't. So the person told me I need to go to the next abattoir, which is vetted by them, and that's like double the distance. So I'm like, okay. So on one hand, you're an assurance scheme that is high welfare, and yet you want me to keep the animals in a trailer for double the time just to get some stupid stamp to sell it. Whereas our customers don't even care about the stamp because they can come to the farm and see. So the moment for me, and I've told them, both of them, I said, look, I don't want anything to do with you.
If any of my customers want to see, you can even come and pick a pig. Come take the avatar.
Yeah.
And that's the openness we need. The reason we have assurance schemes, it may be because we have some people in the industry, and I always say this, we need to applaud the good and call out the bad and either help fix it or get rid of it. We do have people that need to be have their hands held on how to treat animals, how to have good welfare. That's why these assurance schemes are there. But if everyone had an open door policy, they wouldn't have a job. They'll be gone tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. And I don't know what the answer is, because we're just held to ransom with so many things, aren't we? And it's just, you know, for me, being able to step back a bit and just go, right, okay, I feel like I've got the farm in my full control now, where I'm sort of not reliant on commodity prices. I got the quinoa, I got the wine, like it's all going to local market now, which is awesome. And yeah, and now I've got this bloody funny thing over my head. Oh. You know, it's like I've just got here. and now you're doing this to me.
I think the thing is, Emily, is that you're so efficient that things are like, okay, she's got all those boxes ticked. Let's see what she does with this one. And I'm sure you're going to get through it. You're definitely going to get through it.
Yeah. Well, it's only the option. It's right at the beginning. So we're just going hard at the moment. We've got some really good people campaigning in the other villages, because, you know, all the villages around here, they don't want it. I mean, it happens to be on the farm, but they don't want 3,000 houses built here. It's a brand new community. It's going to be schools, warehouses, recreational grounds,
car park,
everything. Fast food joints, KFC. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, just the thought of it being ripped up. Or, you know, we've planted pretty much every tree on this farm. You know, with every hedgerow, I can tell you every stone. You know, turn over every stone, I'll tell you what's there. And I just, you know, to have developed the farm to the niche markets, I suppose, that we've done, it's just heartbreaking to think that they could just come in and rip it up. And the council don't care that it's farmland at all. Yeah, it's like the least of their worries.
Well, they're not going to care, are they? Because if you've got 3,000 homes paying whatever amount of council tax, that's a lot of revenue.
Yeah, but they're still in debt. You know, they're still in debt. Where are they taking that money?
Well, do you know, I heard from a local planner, he said farmland around here is about £10,000 an acre. Farmland with development rights is about between £700 and £1 million an acre.
Yeah, so your landlord is not going to sniff at that.
No,
they're not going to. No, it's okay.
No.
They're going to. Chances are they'll take that and they'll use that somewhere else. So it is just a crap shit situation that I don't know. I just seems to me, no matter what you're talking about, whether you're talking about building 3,000 houses on the side of Bath, you know, I was farm yesterday and I was talking to them, and his cousin had a farm in Litchfield where HS2 literally went straight through the middle of their farm. Mm. So they ruined the farm. So it was a ring fence farm, and the train line went through the farm, like literally through the building, through the house. So they brought this strip of land. And obviously that's now not happening. They've demolished the farm, they've demolished the buildings, they've gone, but then now, and they just turned around and said, well, do you want to buy it back? And the farmer said, well, no, I don't want to buy it back.
No.
Strip of land that you've just completely destroyed, and they've actually sold the remainder of the land either side now and gone down and bought a farm somewhere else, because the neighbours were able, you know, just the neighbours either side would buy that as good land, whatever, I don't know how much it was. And they've gone, and you just think, there's no fault, absolutely no fault to any of this, whether it's HS2 or the biggest Amazon warehouse that's being built. And we're all guilty because we all use Amazon and all these different things, and we all use these different home delivery stuff. But it just, and then you drive into a city and you will see massive areas that are not developed.
Yeah.
because going back to what you said, there's a cost to cleaning that site and doing it and sourcing and getting it right. Whereas some farmland, just crack on, pour some concrete in it, away we go.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's really getting me is they keep talking about affordable housing. I appreciate
housing in
We need affordable housing 100%. That you know, low income homes definitely, but these aren't going to be affordable housing. This is 5 miles from Bath. You've got to be kidding if you think there's going to be anything less than 400 grand. You know,
anything that's normally built, they call it affordable. When I was in Sussex, they did that in a local village, Plumpton. Oh yeah, first time buyers, local affordable, 300 grand. It's like, okay, who's going to afford 300 grand?
And the jobs aren't there, and it's like, it's a real worry, because I feel like there's no cap on building at the moment. It just seems that there's just such a push to build, but who are we accommodating here? Because nobody can afford it. We've got a housing development that went up in the next village, and they're all sat there, half of them empty. No one could afford to live in them. It's just ridiculous.
Did you see that there was a panorama piece, I think?
No, I didn't see that.
Probably 2-3 months ago, maybe towards the end of last year.
Okay.
And it was about the whole thing about Help to Buy and the dodgy deals that went on with developers and the government. Right. And they, like, because some of them where people, you buy a house and you own X amount of it, and in the end, you keep paying, but the payment never ends because you actually never own anything in that house. Mm-hmm. And they were just talking about how these things are advertised as one thing, and then when you get into it, it's a complete sham.
Yeah.
And I think, some of the, like even in Sussex, and my friend is works for the EA. Whenever it rains, there's a town, I think it's Hales Heath. It always floods. Or get roads that always flood because they built all these houses. There's no drainage.
No.
And you just think, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
So the other thing, we are carbon positive as a farm. We're carbon neutral last year. We're moving to, we'll be carbon positive this year because we're not doing any artificial inputs at all. And so we've got really good organic matter, soils, really good health. Like I say, done tons of conservation work. We're doing absolutely everything that the government want us to do. We're ticking every single box. We're doing exactly what the landlord wants us to do, ticking every single box. And yet, when it comes to the crunch, they don't care about any of that, because carbon capture, who cares if you can build a bunch of houses on it? It's like we're doing all the right things. And this is, it's like a, it don't, none of it adds up. You know, we farmers get slammed in the media for ripping out hedges and, you know, destroying farmland and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, but when you do it right, it's not us that's doing it. It's the councils and it's the the sort of money men, the big fat cats at the end who are just going, right, oh, that's a prime bit of land for development. So they're not thinking about anything other than their pockets, you know?
No, they're not. Same question. Would you ever have livestock?
I have livestock in the sense we have sheep on the farm.
Ah,
but they're not my sheep. Alan looks after them. So I get all the good bits of the sheep without actually having to do anything with the sheep. And I'm happy with that. Pigs. You know, I'm scared of animals. I'm happy with plants. I'm going to stick to my plants. I like to see them from afar. I appreciate them. I like eating them. I like looking at them. But no, you can keep your animals. Keep the livestock.
At least he hasn't mentioned goats, so that's a bonus.
Chris is not here to back me up, so I'm never going to bother going down that road.
You'd be outnumbered. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you, Emily. I just think you just hit the nail on the head. Like, you are literally doing everything that the government want a farmer to do. You've diversified. You're carbon, you're carbon positive. You're growing, you know, environmentally friendly crops. You planted a ton. You've done everything apart from you haven't grown any houses, which is obviously the downside. Which is joking aside, I really, really hope that doesn't happen because I know roughly where your farm is, and I just think to myself, you know, just thinking about it now, that's just bonkers to think that there would be a town there.
Mm. You know,
it's absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
But, yeah. No, just, I wish you, well, we both sort of wish you all the luck and.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Yeah. If you need, it's been great. Yeah.
If you need any help noise making, I'll be there.
Oh, thanks, Flav.
Flav likes to do a great test.
I need to come and have a sip of that wine, actually. We'll have to sort a date out.
Because you come up. You come up this way, we'll make sure we crack open a bottle or two. Oh, definitely.
I'll bring some pork to do some pairings.
Amazing. Perfect.
Thank you so much, Emily.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Cheerio.
Well, there we go, Flav. We've done our first three-prong podcast as a two-prong podcast, and I think it went all right. And it was really refreshing to talk to Emily about her farming journey, not only all the diversification that she's doing, but also the really horrible challenges that she's facing that she has absolutely no control over.
Yeah, and I think also, like she said, she's third generation. To see the things she's changing and sort of doing things completely different. I think that's amazing. Props to her and obviously her dad for passing on the farm, but still working on the farm. I'm sure there must be some fun conversation going on there, like they would working with your parent. But I think it's definitely inspiration to see and hear growing things like quinoa and heritage wheat. It's not something many people do in the UK. So I'm starting a vineyard, shit me.
That's definitely not easy. We should just maybe focus the podcast on vineyards myself.
Oh, mate. I wish I had wine on. I know drinking you spoke, wine.
The other day about doing a tour. Vineyard tour, maybe?
UK vineyard tour, that's a shout. That's a good shout. So essentially, good. Go to farms that have diversified with vineyards and just...
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's really nice meat as well, and other things. Yes, that's good. We're all for that.
Nice. See you on the next one.
See you next time.